Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dale, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Today I'm joined by Evan Lucas, Chief Market Strategist with InvestSmart, to talk about one of the more interesting aspects of a really fascinating period in global markets. That is the economic performance of the world's largest economy and what it means for your portfolio. We often make big statements like that, but right now we have the largest tax cuts in US history taking effect. At the same time, record low interest rates that have been in effect for nearly a decade now. This is not a normal scenario. Most of us have never seen anything like this before, either in textbooks or in reality. And we have the added bonus of tariff talk to add to the mix at the moment as well. So I'm really looking forward to getting Evan's thoughts. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Gemma.
So let's talk a little bit about recent history to the scenario we find ourselves in. And I like to give a lot of context, so I apologize for boring everybody, but I think it's really worth thinking about how we ended up in this situation in the first place. The Great Recession in the US started about a decade ago now. So GFC was nearly a decade ago. We'll see all the 10 years on stories really soon. Kicked off by the GFC, the global financial crisis, and then working its way across really all areas of the US economy, or pretty close to it. If you've only been watching the stock market, particularly the tech sector via the NASDAQ, you would imagine the US has been rocketing since 2009. Markets have come back really strongly. It almost looks like straight line growth. And yet, if you look at interest rates, you would think quite differently.
Yeah, so the discussion that we're sort of going to have around all this is the US economy and the US markets are probably the best example of growth markets. So getting back to your point around one, the NASDAQ is where it is. Look at the Russell 2000, you can also look at probably the S&P rather than the Dow. Mm. You can show very clearly that it's growth.
Yes.
EPS growth in the States has been astounding. Mm. Wealth growth is there as well. So that all gets back down to your points around what's happened since, you know, we are going to talk about the fact that in September this year, it's 10 years since Lehman Brothers and everybody remembers those scenes. So that is, you know, the Bernanke put, as it was called, so the QE programs going through three sizes of it, as you said, interest rates going to near enough to zero in the US. Mm. Their rate setup is different to ours. They have probably about 9 floating rates that make up the federal funds rate. Mm. So that's why they say it's a band between whatever it is, which currently sits at 1.75 to 2%. Mm-hmm. All of that is there. It's been a big stimulus for them, but they are now justifying that. And that's, I think, the interesting thing about it. So if you look at their mandate, and this is, we're looking at the Fed here, we'll talk about Trump in a minute, because that's another story.
That's a different thing.
But let's look at the mandates, and that is full employment and inflation. Now, their inflation measure is what they call their PCE, so this is the personal consumption expenditure, which actually comes out in the next couple of days.
Right.
So keep an eye on it. Mm. Core PCE is sitting at about 1.8% in the States. It looks like it's about to go through it.
Okay.
And their band is 2, so they wanted it 2. And that's probably been some people's mandates that are more bearish on it to say, no, we don't want to raise rates, but it's there. Full employment is clearly there.
Mm.
The US numbers in employment is astounding. So the non-farm payrolls, you are seeing between 15 and as much as basically 45-year lows in certain metrics. So unemployment at 3.8%, it's the lowest level it's been since the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
Some people believe it will go to 3.3%.
Right.
Unemployment, that would be the best level since 1953.
Right. So that's quality employment. There's not these issues of underemployment
and that's the good one, isn't it?
Gig economy and all this kind of stuff. None of that's a worry.
Something
about
that Australia would kill for
is
the underutilization rate or the underemployment rate. So that is either those that are unemployed or those that are employed but want more work.
Mm.
That has been falling like a stone in the States. Currently it's about 7.2%. Compare that to Australia, it's about 13.5% to 14%.
Right, okay. So when we talk about the gig economy really disrupting markets and particularly disrupting the employment market, is not as much of a problem there as we might have imagined.
Correct, but also the gig economy is different again. Well, Australia's a bit of an outlier in terms of how they look at the gig economy.
Mm.
It is seen in the way that we do our surveys slightly differently to how the non-farm payrolls work. But in all arguments, it's full employment. I mean, they're still creating around about 200,000 jobs per month.
Mm.
That's an astounding amount of numbers. So it's all there. So getting back to your question about the trade and what's going on with trade, all of this was still, all of what we just discussed, 2016 was an interesting year still. We were coming out of the back of a bit of some ruptures around China trade issues, 2013, 14. We'd had issues in Europe and you had although things in the US were good, they hadn't rocketed up like they have since 2016. I mean, so Trump came in on a populist mandate, and it was the fact that he did go with his tax laws first. And it's you know, you don't need to be an analyst or a rocket scientist to work out that if you're going to cut tax rates by basically taking it from being about 25% down to 12, it's not hard to work out. So the example that I always give with this one is Apple's decisions. So they, part of the tax reform was to actually give you a 12% tax on the repatriation of your funds from overseas.
Yes, so they're bringing the money they thought you'd been hiding.
Correct.
Or that you had been hiding.
Or that you had been hiding, or that you basically had argued that it was too expensive to bring it back, is now allowed to come back.
Yes.
So $370 billion Apple is bringing back to the States.
Right.
And the bill for them, they've managed to do a deal, the bill for them is around about $336 million. So it's not huge. I mean, $336 million is ginormous in terms of what you say, but when you see $370 billion, it's tiny.
Not so much. Yes.
And you're seeing stimulus from Apple. They're hiring a huge amount of staff. But that's, so that's the stimulus of it. You can see it coming. It filters through to all and sundry. It's a very, very stimulus policy. Very stimulus. But that gets back to your point, is we have a US that is full employment, that has, you know, wage growth at 2.7%, which sees inflation going probably not only through 2%, but rapidly through 2%. A central bank's mandate is to basically make sure that they don't have basically a collapse like they did in 2008, but that we don't have an overheating scenario either. So are we about to have the push-pull sort of scale scenario where fiscal policy, so the government's policy, is highly stimulating, massively indebting with
the it's reducing the government's tax take quite dramatically, and the US government is hugely indebted and has been for a very long time, primarily to the Chinese.
Correct. And we're about to have an infrastructure boon with building a wall on Mexico and the other materials that he's doing. So, yeah, it's, you've got to look at that. Right, you've got to look at that from the point of view that the ability for him to raise debt is quite still quite easy, and he's going to do it. We've already seen him do it. He raised an additional $300 billion midway through January, February this year, like that. So it's certainly a high probability. I mean, the way he's going and what is forecasted by 2027, for the first time since the Second World War, the US GDP to debt ratio will go negative. So it'll be 105% of GDP.
Wow.
If he goes the way he's going.
Yeah, if these numbers continue.
Which means he'll be $2 trillion short. So it's an interesting conundrum that we're hearing. It's very stimulatory.
The economy's going well.
Yeah, it's very.
To be stimulating it further is
An interesting
brave
one.
Move.
And then you've got Jay Powell, who is now the head of the chair, who was his appointee. Let's be honest, because there's always a little bit of politics when you look at a central banker, who is very much on the front foot, saying no, things need to slow down.
Let's not be silly.
Yeah, and we know that from the dot plot. So that's they're the most open central bank around. They'll tell you where they think rates will be by the end of this year, end of 2019 and 2020. And it's steepened in the last numbers that they gave us, what, 3 weeks ago. The question now is whether or not it goes even harder. So they're now forecasting 4 rate rises in 2018. We've had 2. September and December are now more than live events. My argument is, if it does get as fast as it looks like it's doing, and we've had 7 rate rises since the bottom, and it still hasn't slowed things down, is that they go harder still. So they're going through 4 this year, 3 next year, and 1 in 2020. Why wait to 2020?
Yeah, what's the purpose? If
If you're trying to slow the economy down and stop inflation getting away and sort of moderate this overheating possibility, why wait?
Do you think it is inflation that is the biggest risk for them?
No, I don't. The biggest risk is definitely, as you've already alluded to, is debt. It's also, there is, at the moment, the other interesting question is how growth has been done. Growth has been, if you look at US GDP, it's really positive, no doubt. But a lot of that's government. So if you look at the so if you look at the GDP equation, for those of you that are listening, so it's consumption, things like household consumption, etc., private investment, government investment, government spending, etc., etc., and then net exports, so exports minus imports. That's the equation of GDP. The G, so the government, has been quite a proponent of that over the last, probably the last three quarters.
When you look at the infrastructure spend that's planned and so on, that's not going to change dramatically. Yep. In fact, it's probably going to increase, right?
It's not a bad, yeah, it is. And this, again, don't look at it as a bad thing. However, again, government spending is good stimulation, but if it's done on debt, there is a scenario there. US debt is, everybody knows, very, very high. The catch to it is the next dilemma from a, and looking at it from a market's perspective, is what now happens in the bond market. And the bond market is the interesting one. So we have seen the US bond market start to really move because the Fed is finally catching them out. And I know that a lot of people are alluding to something that they love looking at, those that are very bearish on the world, which is the spread between the US 2-year and the US 10-year.
So you've talked about this. I really want to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah, and the US 2-year, the US 2-year should be moving the way it is. So what I mean by that is that the US 2-year, short-term dated product, obviously only 2 years to expiry, it's moved 121 basis points in the last year.
Right.
Now, you should expect to see that. Mm. And the reason I say that, twofold, the Fed is raising rates. It is also, therefore, forward-looking and thinking where the rates will be in 2 years' time. So the front end of the curve is you know, probably given an example of why you are seeing it rapidly move up. The interesting one is the 10-year. Now, the reason that you point this out is that every single time you've seen the 2 and 10-year, what they say invert, where the yield on the 2-year goes higher than the yield on the 10-year, you have seen a recession, now very small, most of them, but still a recession, and it is also the biggest indicator of a bear market coming.
Wow.
So it's all
in
there.
Equities?
In equities and basically across the board.
Right.
Again, size is up for debate, but if you overlook at the 152 years of the US markets, so bonds, equities, credit, blah, 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 it has always been an indicator for a bear market and some form of recession.
Right.
So. It's a powerful indicator, and again, going contrarian against it is bloody hard, but but the interesting question is that, so the 2-year I've explained, and it makes complete sense.
Yes.
The issue with the 10-year is this, the 10-year is the most secure, safe product on the planet.
Yeah.
So if you are worried the world is going to end tomorrow, geopolitics, oil runs out, blah, 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 you buy the US 10-year. That's basically theory. Do you think the US government, despite what we've just talked about.
Hugely indebted, slightly wild US government. Yeah.
Is going to fold and not pay its debts? No. So it will pay them.
Even when they're wild.
Even with what's going on, they will always, always pay their debts. So the 10-year is that product. So although we've had 120 basis point rise, so 1.21% rise in the 2-year, the 10-year hasn't moved anywhere near that speed. It's only up around about 40 basis points, and it just cannot go through 3%. So it's sitting at 2.9. So the spread is 35 basis points.
Yeah.
So it's pretty small.
That's close.
And there are reasons for that. Italy, a couple of weeks back, definitely depressed it. You saw more issues around Brexit with the fact that at the moment Theresa May is getting her Brexit materials through. Although it's a completely different nation and a different zone, it still plays effects on the 10-year. Trade wars.
It reflects people's concerns about what's going on in the world, right?
Yeah, then the trade war that we're seeing as well.
Yeah, so let's talk about that because this is the other one that is extraordinary. Extraordinary. I, you know, so when I was at university and we learned about tariffs, I mean, just universally they're a bad thing. They effectively end up making everyone pay more. They distort markets. Tariffs are no good. Let's dismantle as many as possible. Australia became a very open economy by dismantling many, many tariffs. And here we have the president of the US, leader of the free world, if you will, talking tariffs all over the place via Twitter.
Yep.
It's fascinating.
It is, and it also intertwines perfectly into what we just discussed. So as you, what I would say exactly the same way is that tariffs help no one. Because in the end, what does it do? It increases price. What does increasing price do? It increases inflation.
Yeah.
So if you're rapidly increasing inflation through artificial means, you then have the monetary policy issue again in your face. So if products are getting more and more expensive, you have to slow that down. You have to slow that, and that therefore it puts a risk of higher interest rates even more so into that theory.
So what is interesting, and I don't know if there's any history to, and I'm sure there is, to illustrate what happens here, but so if I'm the Fed and I think I need to increase rates to slow down inflation, mm-hmm. but the inflation's being driven mm-hmm. by fiscal policy I can't control,
correct,
and effectively exogenous factors, does it have the right effect? Does it do anything?
No, and it doesn't. And,
so it's,
and
ineffective,
it's ineffective, but necessary. And this is the catch with it, isn't it? Mm. Is that so? We'll talk about the effects on us here in Australia in a sec, mm. but that is the argument as well, is mm. that you have a completely arbitrary thing mm. that it shouldn't be driving inflation, that is. Mm. And when you have mandates that, that central banks do mm. and the issues that come with that, I mean, it's the Fed could realistically sit on its hands, and it probably would. In a real-world scenario, it probably mm. would, because it's a risk to be raising rates with tariffs that are all raising prices anyway.
Yeah, you just crunch the consumer.
Yeah, exactly. So you would all of a sudden have a fairly fast deterioration in GDP because
yeah.
consumption slows down. Mm. But it's more around, this is all an interesting conundrum, as you've already alluded to, in that it does definitely retard trade.
Mm.
The impact on GDP can be very clearly shown that it's going to be quite modest. It's not mm. the point. It's more that it is the relation issues. Mm. So the China story is an interesting one, but it's not mm. just China. I know we were talking about this off air, but mm. if you look at, it's not just the Chinese trade issues, mm. it's the fact that he's targeting allies as well. So
yeah.
the overall total tariff importation at the moment, so this is implemented and threatened, so let's call it what it is,
yeah.
it's around $800 billion of additional tariffs. And it's astonishing. And the one that will really make people sit up mm. is if he hits the Europeans with an auto tariff.
Right.
So if he was to go after the German car makers,
mm.
which is a probability considering mm. how strong he was when he came in around BMW moving a plant in the southwest
mm.
into Mexico,
mm.
Shows that he means business mm. around this. And it is, I mean, it's his bread and butter, it's his Rust Belt states,
mm.
it's the Midwest. Ford and GM have been hurting him for a while.
Mm.
How do you appeal to those voters? Well, you hit the international players that clearly monster his mm. part of the market. So the Germans would be the ones to watch. There's the Japanese as well,
mm.
and he's threatening them. And that's really surprising, because Shinzo Abe has been very hands-off and very supportive whenever Trump is around.
Yeah.
And the Japanese have also had a political reason, being North Korea. Now,
mm.
maybe what happened a couple of weeks back could be part of that in
mm.
slowing that down. But for him to touch Japan would be another story. And so getting back to the Australian-centric point of view
mm.
is that China is the one.
Mm.
Our 37% of our exports go to China.
Mm.
China's largest export nation is the US of manufactured goods.
Mm.
And most of that is some form of steel product.
So my question for you was going to be, we're talking about the US, this very complex scenario where you've got stimulating fiscal policy, but then a restrictive fiscal policy as well. Like, tariffs are restrictive in many, many ways, plus a monetary policy that's incredibly expansive but tightening.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many variables. It's quite fascinating to observe, and how it's going to play out is really interesting. We talk about the US all the time. As an Australian investor and an Australian consumer, it's easy to assume it doesn't have an impact, but you're telling us right now it has a huge impact.
Oh, it has
right?
a huge impact. And global markets are that.
Mm.
They are. We will not escape global mm. movements. We just don't.
Mm.
We have somehow managed to do it over the last couple of months, which is quite interesting.
Mm.
So we have been slightly isolated to the movements in mm. US markets. But in the end, it will hit us. And
mm.
what I mean by that is, if you look at those that have actually contributed major points to our market
mm.
since April, so since this all really kicked off,
yeah.
they're actually international providing players. So CSL is a good example.
Yeah.
BHP is a good example. They've actually added points to the ASX since April.
Yeah.
They have tailwinds from the currency, something we haven't even spoken about. But
yeah,
the others.
That was gonna be another
so
question.
You've got CSL, Macquarie is another one with big earnings overseas.
Mm.
That the interesting thing about Macquarie is that Macquarie actually has a fair reasonable exposure to the euro, and the euro hasn't done anything near the amount of depreciation against the Aussie as we have against the US.
Yeah.
So you will see this, in that the interesting question will be, is that a CSL is a great example,
mm.
In that if the US dollar does tick up off the back of all this risk and blah, 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 there's other reasons why it might not, but let's just take that for simple reasons.
Mm.
That's why it's getting a tailwind. It means that when it repatriates money back into Aussie dollars, it's getting a better price. It's fairly simple economics on that too. But if you look at a BHP and we do start to see tightening and tariffs hitting steel and aluminium exports, you know, Rio Tinto's already seen it with their operations in Canada, with the Canadians being targeted by steel and aluminium tariffs. BHP is the next one, that if they were to start slowing down on, you know, products out of China, demand for iron ore and demand for that kind of product slows down. They're still our largest exporter of gas as well. So there are things that you will see. You'll then also just see general market flows slow down. So the investment wealth that's been flowing through markets for the last 10 years because of all this monetary policy we've spoken about will slow. And therefore the funds that flow around global markets also slows down. And that therefore means you'll either get a moderation or you will get a decline.
So my question for you then is, as an Australian investor, and our investors tend to be hugely overweight the ASX, some exposure to international markets through ETFs commonly, they'll have some managed funds and they'll have some Australian stocks with substantial offshore earnings, as you've alluded to. What would you be doing?
So I'm still, although we've been talking about fairly bearish scenarios, I'm still fairly moderate. And what I mean by that is that growth is still very good. So if you look at where global
if you
look at global output expectations from the World Bank, from the IMF, and then collate it with the major investment banks, it's sitting at 4.1% for this year. So it's still very strong. So you need to be balanced. And what I mean by that is, I agree with you completely. The Australian, you know, the Australian investor is very, very overweight, the Australian market. It's not a bad thing until you sort of look at where they're overweight, and they are heavily, heavily overweight financials because they have been a great returner. There's no argument about that over the last 10 years. My thing now is that you want to start trying to plug holes and moderate. So if you look at the return over the last year versus the return, total returns this is, over the last 10 years, all of this smooths out. So if you have overexposure to the ASX, almost no exposure to property, for example, some exposure internationally, some with cash, and maybe some with fixed interest, give or take. So that's the normal asset allocation diversification. You will do well in 1 or 2 years, but then you'll have years where you'll get smashed because you're not technically diversified. If you are smoothed out across those four, over a 10-year period, the total returns will mean that you actually sort of see through this quite a lot easier. So if you are nimble, by all means, I'm not saying you shouldn't be, but I am now getting to a point where I'm like, okay, I need to start probably looking at it from the point of view, I've loved growth, and I still do. Do I wait to see that top out? Because you know the NASDAQ is still going gangbusters, and so is most growth markets.
China's 100 times is perfectly reasonable for a stock, right?
Yeah, and then, exactly right. But then you've got a China story, which is telling me things are slowing down. So I am starting to plug the holes where I have been underweight things like cash. I have been underweight international equities until probably the end of last year. So making sure that I'm now even for a possible fall. It even means of having a tiny portion to even safer assets. And that is bonds or, I can't believe I'm going to say this, a little bit of gold. Now, I hate gold. Yes. I hate gold. But if you look at the gold price, it has held dead steady for the last 18 months. So from my perspective is that if we did see a fall, and it's probable, if we did see a fall, I've got something holding value. And I'm not losing the gains that I've had over the last couple of years. Because the other way you look at it is that you have now, possibly some of you could have even returned 20 to 30%, those of you that are really, really good at it. I'd be more looking at, I'm happy with 11% per annum total return. I don't want to lose that, but I still want to continue to grow. So I'm still very much leveraged towards that idea. I still got very big international exposure, Australian exposure, but I'm starting to start putting in things like fixed income, bit of cash and a tiny bit of gold, just to hedge myself against the probability of some form of movement. Now, I'm of not of the view that it's a bear market. There will be a pullback slash maybe a correction, so 5 to 10%. But if I'm wrong and it does go harder, I've got a protection.
You've got something to protect you. Evan, absolutely love it. super helpful. You produce regular updates, lots of commentary on these issues. You do little snapshots, which is great, and lots of different bits of commentary people can get access to. Where would they go to find out?
Yeah, so all of my material is at InvestSmart. So by all means, please log on to the InvestSmart website. All of my stuff is there. It's under MarketWatch. I'm also there on Twitter and on email, so you're more than welcome to hit me up. I love Twitter, and I love having Twitter discussions.
Yeah.
Not wars, but Twitter discussions. So I am always open to people reaching out either through the website or through social media.
Yeah, fantastic. And we publish a lot of InvestSmart content on NavTrade, so a lot of our investors will see you there too.
Lovely.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jenna.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Your Wealth. We always love to hear from you, like Evan. So if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nav.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nav.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nav.com.au.